Kia ora, tēnā, I'm Joe Horner. Pleased to see you all again today. This is our last session for 2023, and it's great to welcome back Glenn Harper, one of our regular presenters, and it's also, we appreciate Glenn's efforts for these presentations that we've now been doing for 7 or 8 years, and they're really superb. Without further ado, welcome again, Glenn. We'll hand over to you. This one was on the 80th anniversary series for World War II, so what happened in 1943, particularly the closing stages of the North African campaign. So without standing any more flunder, welcome, Glenn.
Thank you. Thanks, Joe, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be back here, particularly on a day like this. Pulls me away from Foxton Beach, where I could be fishing, but I don't resent it.
Joe. Oh, yeah. You said you were on Coast Guard duty for that.
No, that was last Saturday, but never mind. Yeah, my talk today is from Tripoli to Kruna, 2nd New Zealand Division's last campaigns in North Africa. And this is what I'm going to be talking about pretty much. I'm going to start with the division reaching Tripoli, several new developments that happened in Tripoli. I'm going to talk about a much forgotten battle, one which I think is really, really important, but admirers of General Rommel tend to forget about it because it's his worst defeat, and they tend to push it aside and call it an incident rather than a battle, which I find somewhat strange. I'm going to talk about the outflanking of the Marath Line, the two operations, which really were the really big focus in Tunisia, Operation Pugilist, which turns into disaster, very reminiscent of Operation Lightfoot at El Alamein, but then Operation Supercharge, which is really a textbook operation on how a military battle should be conducted. Going to look at a couple of other incidents, and look at the Rumus VC, and look at Infightable and Takruna, and talk about the Manahi case, and then talk about the end in North Africa and its significance to the war as a whole. So by way of introduction, I'll talk about a couple of things. The Battle of El Alamein, which also happened time ago, some 81 years ago now, 23rd of October to the 4th of November, which was the turning point battle for North Africa. This is where things change for the Germans, where everything starts to go wrong for them from this time on, and where things improve for the Allies. And El Alamein coincided with Operation Torch, the Allied invasion of French North Africa, which after a rather tenuous start did really, really well and cleared French North Africa and won it for the Allies. But Hitler was absolutely furious. He was furious with the defeat at El Alamein and that Rommel had ignored his orders and withdrawn, and he was absolutely over, you know, his name for him, he was a tippet biter, a carpet biter, you know, those people would get really, really mad and fall on the floor and bite the carpet. He had one of those fits about the French and the shiftiness of Vichy French, and he made a critical decision, and it was one of the great errors. He made several, particularly declaring war on the United States, but this was another terrible decision of his, and that was to send massive reinforcements to North Africa. Now, Rommel had been starved of supplies and men, but from November 1942 to January 1943, Hitler sent some 243,000 men, so almost quarter of a million men, and 856,000 tons of supplies and equipment to Tunisia by sea and by air. So it's a massive reinforcement. A reinforcement that would eventually enable the Germans to establish a complete new army in Tunisia, the 5th Panzer Army. So with the 5th Panzer Army, plus the Italian forces, plus the Deutsches Afrika Korps, that was a considerable force that outnumbered the Allies. And Tunisia would be where the Axis forces would make their last stand in North Africa, which meant some 5 months of tough, hard fighting, which would see the New Zealanders involved in some of the critical battles of that campaign's last months. See? But we have the New Zealand division entering Tripoli on the 23rd of January 1943. There had been some rearguard actions by the Germans, but not much serious fighting. The New Zealanders weren't the first to enter Tripoli, but they were close behind the 11th Hussars who were. And this is a slide of the members of the Maori Battalion in their final stage of this advance into Tripoli. And the New Zealand division remained in Tripoli for what Kippenberger calls, and I'm quoting from his book Infantry Brigadier, 6 very enjoyable and interesting weeks. So what did they do while they were in Tripoli? Because 6 weeks is a long time to spend out of the line in a campaign like this. One of the key things that they did was the Churchill Parade, the Churchill Victory Parade, to mark the Battle of El Alamein on the 4th of February. This was a magnificent occasion. Freyberg described it as the most impressive and moving parade of my career. He was quite happy because Churchill actually started to speak to him again. Churchill and Freyberg had been friends, but Churchill had not spoken or contacted Freyberg for almost 2 years because he hadn't forgiven him for Crete. But now, because of El Alamein, everything was hunky-dory between them. And at that parade, Churchill praised the New Zealand division for what he called its glories in North Africa, and he described Freyberg as, quote, the salamander of the British Empire. And I have to say, nobody in the New Zealand division knew what a salamander was at that time. And Freyberg turned to his aide, who was quite an educated person, John White, and said, "What did he call me?" "He called you a salamander, sir." And Freyberg turned around and said to him, "Is that a cooking pot?" But no, it wasn't. It was a mythical lizard that can live in fire, and that was the allusion he was making to Freyberg being wounded and being able to survive in battle and so forth. And as you see, Freyberg High School uses that salamander as its emblem. So that was one of the important things that they did while they were in Tripoli. Another thing that they did was they had a tactical exercise without troops, where officers from the 1st Army and the US 2nd Corps came and watched the 8th Army put it through its paces, and the New Zealand Division was one of the ones chosen to put on a mock attack. I've got to say, one General George Patton was in attendance, as was General Beadle Smith. And Kippenberger took great delight in observing Patton, because Patton spent all the time in the room in the tube staring at the ceiling and chewing gum, and later said it meant nothing to him. So, he thought he didn't have much to learn from the British, unfortunately. The New Zealand Division was also involved in clearing the Tripoli docks, which had suffered great damage. Let's put that down and turn my page over. Freyberg was on leave, Kippenberger was the acting divisional commander, parties of soldiers were used to unload ammunition and supplies, and during that time Kippenberger had a run-in with Montgomery when an ammunition barge exploded and killed 3 men and destroyed a large amount of ammunition. And this was what we call in the Army an interview without coffee. Kippenberger was marched in and given a dressing down by Montgomery. And Montgomery said, "Your men have been smoking and I don't want it to happen again." Kippenberger said, "Well, I don't think they were. There's no evidence of it. It could just have been an explosion." Montgomery says, "When I say your men were smoking, they were smoking." But Kippenberger protested, and Montgomery said, "Well, see, it doesn't happen again, now get out of my sight." So not a great relationship with Montgomery, who could be rather prickly when he wanted to be. This is one of the most important things that happened to the division in Tripoli. The 8th reinforcement arrived. This was the first reinforcements the New Zealand division had received since October 1941. So for all of 1942, all those big battles they're fighting at Rewisatte Ridge, 1st Alamein, 2nd Alamein, they're not receiving any reinforcements at all. And this is the first reinforcements that they received for well over 18 months. And it included 100 officers, and many of them Dunturin graduates, 3,000 men, which the official history states helped to give new life to the division. They were certainly going to be needed in the battles ahead. And the other thing that happened at Tripoli, which is also important, is that a new weapon was received. A 17-pounder anti-tank gun, known as the Pheasants. And 7th New Zealand Anti-Tank Regiment was issued with 16 of these new guns. And you can see the difference between a 17-pounder on the left and a 2-pounder on the right, which had been the main anti-tank gun for most of 1941 and 42, once described as a matchstick on wheels. But it had this 17-pounder, had a high muzzle velocity, great range and hitting power, was more than the equivalent of the German 88mm. And at last I've got this magnificent anti-tank gun. Now I'm going to move on to this Battle of Medinet. Tripoli had been taken, Tripoli had been used as a base to build up, and Montgomery followed up Rommel's withdrawal with two weak divisions. You'll see on the map that I put up next, this one here, we're going the wrong way, this one here, that Rommel has withdrawn to the Marath line, which I'll talk about later on. You see Marath just above Medinet, and Rommel has followed up that withdrawal with only two weak divisions, the 51st Highland Division and the 7th Armoured Division. And they reach Medinet across the border in Tunisia, 270 kilometres away from Tripoli. So they're out there on their own, and they're quite isolated. Now, Rommel manages to inflict two said severe defeats on the Americans. I'm going to have to show you where they are. I'm coming around here. At this place here called Kazarine or Kazarine Pass, and another battle here at Sabaiba. So he actually gives the American US Second Corps a bloody nose, and that gives him a time now to muster his forces and turn south to deal with the advancing 8th Army. And he was decided to attack Montgomery's small force at Medinet, remember there are only two divisions, with three complete armoured divisions and 16 battalions of infantry. And he plans that attack for the 3rd of March. But as we all know, as soon as these signals are going out and Rommel reveals what he's going to do and he needs supplies and so forth, they're being intercepted by Ultra, and that information is passed on to Montgomery, who has one of those horrible moments, realising that his force is now unbalanced, and he decides to rush as many forces forward from Tripoli to Medinet as possible, including the New Zealand Division. They get the order to rush to Medinet on the 2nd of March, and they're there by the 3rd of March, and they're well and truly in line, ready for this attack. This is quite a confusing diagram. It's a battle map, but it shows what I really want to show. In the north, we have the 51st Highland Division. We have the 201st Brigade of Guards in the middle. And the New Zealanders, just one brigade, 5 New Zealand Brigade in the south. With an armoured division, 7th Armoured in reserve. Now, Kippenberger, who is the commander of 5 Brigade, just prepares at Medinet what he later described, and I'm quoting from a few brigadier, our masterpiece in the art of laying out a defensive position under desert conditions. He had the whole front bristling with anti-tank guns, including the new 17-pounder Pheasant, with orders that they were not to be used unless it was absolutely necessary. Now, Montgomery had some good luck here, because Rommel had to delay his attack from the 3rd of March to the 6th of March to build up these forces, and it was an unmitigated disaster. You can see the three armoured divisions and where they attack. You have 15 Panzer in the north, 21st Panzer in the centre, and 10 Panzer from this new army they've created, which will attack 5 Brigade in the south. Rommel attacks with 124 tanks and 16 battalions of infantry, and he loses half those tanks in this attack. 52 tanks are destroyed. Not a single British tank is engaged or involved in this battle, and it shows how far the 8th Army and 2nd New Zealand Division have come in this war. This is this battle is often skipped over in any biographies of Rommel, which tend to be quite hagiographic, but it is quite a significant battle. It's his swan song in Africa. He's not a well man, and he has to leave shortly after and never return to North Africa again. Significance of this battle is it shows at last the British Army now realise that tanks are not designed to fight tanks. Tanks are infantry killers. Okay, they should be used against infantry and not other tanks. How do you destroy tanks? You leave it to your artillery and anti-tank guns to destroy armour. The anti-tank defence in depth now provided a conclusive answer to the armoured attacks which had caused so much damage to them in the past. This Menin is the most successful defensive battle the Allies fight in North Africa. So I'm just going to do a bit of a sideline here. Because it was such a success, Montgomery insisted on bringing all his senior officers over and to talk about the positions and why things had gone so well. The day before he did that, he did his own reconnaissance and he visited Kippenberger and Kippenberger's fire brigade position, and he said to Kippenberger, "You've laid out this defensive position really well. I want you to explain to me the principles that you've used." And Kippenberger said to him, "Oh, look, sir, it's just a standard defensive position, nothing special." And Montgomery insisted, he said, no, I want you to tell me what principles you've observed in this defensive position." So Kippenberger rattled off eight. He said, "Well, sir, I always follow these eight principles in a defensive position. Concealment is absolutely vital. Got to have observation over every part of the front. We want defence in depth. Every position is covered by fire. We want our anti-tank guns being able to mutually support each other," and so on. He rattled off eight principles, and obviously Montgomery didn't say anything, just nodded and walked away. Very next day, Montgomery turns up with all these senior officers from 8th Army in tow, and he says, "Take a look at this defensive position. See how they've followed my eight principles of defence." Talk about plagiarism, I guess everybody wants to own a good idea. Right, we now move on to the really big battle that's fought in Tunisia, and that is the Battle of the Marath Line. Now, the Marath Line is actually a very strong and enforced defensive position. I just need to come round and show you where it is on this map. This is what we're talking about here, the Marath Line, which follows this wadi all the way across here into the Matamata Hills. Here's Menin, and that route is actually the route that the New Zealanders are going to follow in this great outflanking movement that is planned by Montgomery. So the Marath Line follows this wadi, a natural tank obstacle with steep banks which rise some 21 metres high, or 70 feet. They've been reinforced by the French, and it crosses the coastal plain, and you can see these towns from Zarat in the north to Jizun in the south and beyond. Now, Montgomery plans to assault the Marath Line on the 20th of March 1943, and it is going to be the largest set-piece battle fought by the 8th Army since El Alamein, Operation Pugilist. And Montgomery wrote in the plan for Operation Pugilist, and I quote from it, "The object of Operation Pugilist is to destroy the enemy now opposing 8th Army on the Marath Line and to advance and capture the village of Sfax." Now, Sfax is not on that map. It's a coastal town much further north. Now, it was going to do two things, and this is a better map of it. It was going to combine a frontal assault on the Marath Line with this giant left hook, which would outflank the Marath Line and come in behind it at a place called Tobaga Gap. Now, the British 8th Army's frontal assault was going to be the main effort, but the New Zealand Corps, which was formed just before Operation Pugilist, was to play a vital part, and it was reinforced to a massive size. The New Zealand Corps consisted of the New Zealand Division, obviously, 8th Armoured Brigade, which had three regiments of heavy tanks, the King's Dragoon Guards of armoured cars, regiments of medium artillery, a Free French Column, and other units, including a Greek unit as well. All told, Freiburg, as the corps commander, has some 27,000 men under command, 112 guns, 172 anti-aircraft guns, 150 tanks. That's a powerful force to be coming in behind you. In fact, Freiburg has more tanks than the Africa Corps at this time. Now, the New Zealand Corps conducted a difficult night march, and it reached Tobaga Gap on the night of the 20th of March. The frontal assault went in on the Marath Line the next day, and failed. It was a disastrous attack, but Freiburg failed to deliver a solid blow in the rear. On the 21st of March, he carried out some small attacks to take the Italian positions. 6th Brigade carried out a magnificent night attack and actually punched a hole clear through Tobaga Gap, with Gentry urging Freiburg, and I'm quoting from the war diary, "We are right through, we can do anything we like now. Send the 8th Armoured Brigade." But Freiburg did not do that. He dithered around and did not commit any more forces to it. And I have to say, I'm being fairly blunt here, Freiburg is largely responsible for Operation Pugilist's failure. Now, similar to the Alamein battle, Montgomery again realised that his plan hadn't worked. He always lied that it did, everything went according to my plan, but it didn't. But his ability is in the decision to switch direction of the attack. Okay, the frontal assault hasn't worked. We've had more success coming in behind them, if only Freiburg had been a bit more aggressive. So that is where I'm going to reinforce success. And he decides to send the 1st Armoured Division, which is their most powerful armoured force, under the command of General Horrocks. Now, this is a rather sticky situation for the New Zealanders, because Freiburg and Horrocks are of the equivalent rank. And the dispute is, who is in command? And the problem is, too, that Freiburg doesn't like Horrocks and did not make him welcome. And the only reason I can see for this is he thinks Horrocks is a Johnny-come-lately, the new boy with no sand in his boots. And I have to say, I interviewed Sir Leonard Thornton many years ago, and Sir Leonard told me that this was the only time he knew where General Freiburg behaved badly. His staff were embarrassed because they really liked Horrocks and thought he was a really good commander. But Freiburg made life difficult for Horrocks, but Horrocks rolled with the punches and went on with it. Now, this may sound like heresy, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think the reality is that Freiburg struggled when he had to command anything higher than a division. At corps command, he really struggled to get it right. And you have to look at Crete, Tobaga Gap, and we'll look at Casino, I guess, again next year. Anyway, plans are made, and on the 26th of March, a huge attack is launched, given the codename Operation Supercharge 2. Supercharge 1 had been at El Alamein, the last attack that broke the German back, and they're hoping to do the same here. And Supercharge 2 is an immense success. From this map, hopefully you'll see that it's the two brigades are in line, they punch through, and one armoured brigade goes right through and reaches the town of Gubbs. They've actually cut off the defenders on the Marath line. This battle is of immense significance. It's a blitzkrieg-style operation that goes ahead in daylight, most unusual for the New Zealand Division. There are 20 squadrons of Spitfires, Kitty Hawks, Hurricane Tank Busters, which are used to provide very effective close air support. There is the perfect coordination of ground and air forces. There's also excellent cooperation between armour, artillery and infantry. And the 1st Armoured Brigade performs magnificently under Horrocks' command. I have to say, this is an indication that at last the Allies are learning how to make war properly. And we're now at March 1943. So huge success. Burst clean through the Marath line. The New Zealand Corps follows up the 1st Armoured Division, reaches Gubbs on the 29th of March. The Tobaga Gap left hook is the greatest and final operation of that kind in North Africa. But, and here's the big but, the battle continues well after the Marath line is broken, because there is one place which has not been cleared of German defenders, and this is Point 209 at Tobaga Gap. Unfortunately, Point 209 had not received much attention from those aeroplanes that were attacking. When the tanks of 1st Armoured Brigade tried to take the position, they veered away because it was a concealed 88mm gun that knocked out five of them, and they thought, well, we're not going to take any more losses there. And 209 was tenaciously held by the defenders who were from the 164th German Light Division. And they fought tenaciously. In fact, this fight continues for 3 days after the pass has been taken. It is an epic struggle, and it's one which the Maori Battalion ranks among its greatest honours. At times there were hand-to-hand fighting, and when the Maori soldiers ran out of ammunition, they resorted to throwing rocks at the enemy at close range. And for his courageous leadership on Point 209, 23-year-old 2nd Lieutenant Timoana Nui, a Kiwi Ngaramu, was awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross. This is the first Victoria Cross awarded to a Maori serving with New Zealand forces. There was one awarded to an airman of Maori descent in the First World War, but this is the first awarded to a Maori serving with New Zealand forces. Now, Point 209 was finally taken after a complete company attack with 231 German POWs, most of which were wounded. The Maori Battalion suffered heavy casualties, 98 in total, with 22 being killed, another 76 wounded. Now, Kippenberger went over the site the next day with the Maori CO, Charles Bennett, and he said this about it. There was a most horrible scene of slaughter. There were more dead and mangled Germans everywhere, more than I had seen in a small area since the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And I've got to say, that's really saying something. But, let's see, sort my notes. So the Mouth Line's fallen, Tobaga Gap has been through Tobaga Gap, a huge success, but the Germans are able to withdraw in good order and slipped away to the north. This is a sad indictment upon the Allies, I think. They're never able to cut off and destroy retreating German armies. And I have to say, the Soviets only managed it once in Operation Bagration. So we now have these final battles in northern Tunisia, with the Germans being squeezed into an ever smaller pocket by the 8th Army from the south, the 1st Army and the US 2nd Corps from the northwest. And I'll just come around and talk about these maps. This is the outflanking movement around through the Tobaga Gap, and of course then they are able to push further north up, and we're reaching this town here of Invitable. You have the 1st Army under General Anderson coming in from the northeast, and of course, US 2nd Corps, US 2nd Corps under Bradley, 1st Army under Anderson, of course, 8th Army under Montgomery, and that pocket is getting ever, ever smaller. And that's where the Germans will make their last stand around the city of Tunis up in the north. They're now hemmed in. Now, part of the Axis new line of defence was in the rocky terrain around Invitable, which is 100 kilometres south of Tunis. On the 19th and the 20th of April 1943, the 2nd New Zealand Division set off on its last major action in North Africa. It was to clear the foothills between Invitable and Takruna as part of Operation Eration. And here we have the 10 Corps plan for Operation Eration. The 2nd New Zealand Division's part was going to be a two-brigade attack, 6th Brigade on the right, tasked with capturing Invitable and the plain around it, and 5th Brigade on the left, tasked with to capture Takruna and another small hill called Jebel Burr. This is a core attack, so here's the New Zealand start line, got 15th Northumberland Division on the right flank, 4th Division on the left flank is the New Zealand Division, 6th New Zealand Brigade are taking Invitable and the plain, 5th New Zealand Brigade taking this place here, Takruna, and a small hill just slightly to its northeast called Jebel Burr. And so this is the last big action in North Africa. Now Takruna, and here you see it here, and there are some people standing on the mosque on top of Takruna, is a formidable objective. It's an outcrop of rock rising steeply from the Invitable plain, and it dominates that plain. It's some 450 to 500 feet high, and the last 20 feet you can see are steep and almost sheer. and it's extremely well defended. Now, I have to say, as you know, I wrote a biography of General Kippenberger, and I've got to say, this is not his finest hour. He underestimated how difficult it is going to be to capture Takruta, and he makes a number of critical mistakes. He is overconfident, and he's basically saying, oh, the defenders are only Italians, you know, they'll probably pack it in really quickly. He sets deep objectives with limited time to meet them. They haven't adjusted their timings to new terrain. He does not do a reconnaissance and relies just on aerial photographs. And not enough attention is given to the importance of Takruna. He commits too few troops to take it in just one company, and they take it after they've gone past it. He doesn't have a brigade reserve, and he's underestimated the resolve of the enemy. In short, this is his greatest tactical blunder of the war. He has, in effect, marched his brigade into a lethal killing ground, and the heavy casualties that result will reduce him to tears. Takruta becomes a real soldier's battle. It's eventually captured after 2 days of heavy fighting, with troops from the Maori battalion capturing its summit after a grueling climb and hand-to-hand fighting. They're ejected from it, and they go back and do it again, and particularly do so under the leadership of a small group of Maori soldiers led by Sergeant Hani Manahi. Also, soldiers from 23rd Battalion had joined in the fight. Takruna was taken and held, but the cost was high. 46 killed in action, 404 wounded, 86 missing. Kippenberger lost nearly half the troops he committed to this battle. And then there is the Manahi case, which I'm going to talk about now. The Corps Commander, General Brian Horrocks, that's the same Horrocks that Freyberg treated so badly at Tobaga Gap, actually came forward and watched Manahi and a small group of soldiers recapture Takruna. And he described it in his autobiography, and I'm quoting from him, and you can see it there, "The most gallant feat of arms I witnessed in the course of the war." He goes on to say, "To this day, I could not imagine how it was captured in the face of tenacious enemy resistance." Now, this Horrocks has quite a war. I mean, he's there at El Alamein, he's there at Tobaga Gap, he's there at Tunisia. He's the Corps Commander for the drive to Arnhem, so he sees a lot of war, and he describes this as the most gallant feat of arms he saw during the war. Now, Manahi is recommended for a Victoria Cross, which is, Kippenberger wrote the citation. It was supported by Freyberg, the divisional commander. It was supported by Horrocks, the corps commander. It was supported by Montgomery, the army commander. It went off to the UK and came back as an immediate DCM. So he didn't get the Victoria Cross. He got the Distinguished Conduct Medal instead. And for years, Maori leaders believed, I'm quoting from their Waitangi claim, that a gross injustice, that's what it says, was done to Manahi, and they lobbied to have that DCM changed to a Victoria Cross, which included a claim before the Waitangi Tribunal lodged in the year 2000 by the Te Arawa Maori Trust Board, which is at its Y893. As we know, that did not happen. There was a resolution in 2006 where an altar cloth, a special sword and a personal letter from the Queen was received instead. Was an injustice done to Manahi? Absolutely, but I've got to say he's not alone. Many others have been recommended for the Victoria Cross and have often been overlooked for the most significant actions. And some Victoria Cross people have been recommended actually got nothing. At least Manahi got the Distinguished Conduct Medal. These are the fortunes of war, and you can't expect war to be fair. It just isn't. It doesn't work like that. Let me move on now and talk about the German surrender in North Africa, which is coming very soon. The Axis forces, the Italians and Germans, are being starved of supplies. Every air and naval movement is being picked up through Ultra and stopped. All ship convoys were halted at the end of March. The Germans tried to maintain an air bridge, but they lost over 200 transport aircraft doing that. without fuel, ammunition, and being squeezed in an ever smaller pocket, and with their backs to the Mediterranean, and most German soldiers hated having the sea at their back, there was only one way this was going to end. And it ended on the 13th of May 1943, when 275 Axis soldiers laid down their arms. Now let me just show you this picture here. This is the final drive towards Tunis. That is the British First Army coming from the north, the 8th Army coming from the south, and every one of those dotted positions are the number of POWs they captured, and it adds up to 275,000 Axis soldiers. That's a defeat to match Stalingrad. In fact, in numbers, the numbers are quite similar, and it eliminates all German reserves in the Mediterranean. On the 13th of May, Freiburg is the Corps commander still, and here we have a picture of him accepting the surrender of Marshal Giovanni Mises' 1st Italian Army and Major General Kurt Liebenstein's 164 Light Africa Division. The end in Africa is over, and it is a significant defeat. This is the significance of North Africa. I have to say, for most of the war, the North African campaign is a sideshow for the Germans. For most of the time, they have some three divisions fighting there, where if you look at the invasion for Barbarossa, that started with over 200. It is the main theatre of war for the British and the Italians. And the United States come to it late in 42, primarily for political reasons. But Hitler's belated decision to reinforce the Axis in North Africa after Operation Torch is disastrous. It delayed the outcome by about 5 months, but it magnified the scale of that defeat tenfold. And North Africa would then become the springboard into Europe via Sicily and Italy. And those battles that we've talked about, El Alamein, Medinine, outflanking the Maroth Line, the final battles in Tunisia in 1942 to 43, are part of this major shift in the Second World War, known as the turn of the tide. And I have to say, the New Zealand Division is at the forefront of all of 8th Army's victories in North Africa. This is the turn of the tide. The German string of victories are over. Germany has lost the initiative. And I'm going to, the Nazi Germany could not win unless the Allied coalition forces fell apart. Like Germany in 1914 to 18, it could not fight a war on two fronts and expect to win. However, I've got to say, we're still at May 1943, and the war has still got another 2 years to run. But in relation to North Africa, I'm going to leave you with the evocative last line of the New Zealand official history, and it says this: "Not for nothing had these men come 10,000 miles from their homeland, the New World, to play their part in restoring a balance in the old." We're talking now about the contribution New Zealand made to this campaign, vitally important campaign, 80 years ago in North Africa. And I'll leave it there.
Excellent. Questions. Don't fire them all at once.
Why did the Germans go into Africa to start with?
Basically to help out the Italians, which had received a hammering in North Africa towards the end of 1940, where a small force, Wavell's 30,000, had defeated and captured over 300,000 Italians. And he wanted to basically secure that flank so he wouldn't have to worry about it. It was a small commitment, initially only going to be two divisions, an armoured division and a light division, the 90th Light, but then he sent another division, and he really, when Rommel started to win victories, always outnumbered, but won a series of victories from 41 through to 42, Hitler quite liked it, but refused to give him any more resources, even though Rommel wanted it. So basically there to help prop up the Italians.
Do we have anybody here who fought on the Axis side during the war, particularly in the desert? I do. I've adopted both my sisters. Their fathers fought for the Italians, the Axis forces. One in the Mediterranean Sea, the other in Italy at the Home Guard. My dad and Maria's father met in the war. They drew their weapons on each other. Dad said, "Good morning, Mussolini cadet. How are you today?" Maria drew his favourite. "Buongiorno, signor New Zealand, a solidaire. Gi arrivederci. Gi arrivederci, tomati. O in arrivo o in departure. Si bona bene, si non puncture, non a compito, ne giù in grado. Grazie, grazie." Each came to attention, did a right turn, and off they went.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. I'm sure that that will go down in the recording quite well. Any other questions? Yeah.
Long-range business
involved
Japan
Yes, they were, and it's one of the problems was actually whether it was passable or not, and the long-range desert group had been used to reconnoitre the way around the Matamata Hills, and one of them found a vital gap called Wilder's Gap, and Wilder had served in the long-range desert group. Yes, they were. They didn't take, tended not to take part in battles but certainly reconnaissance and raids on the enemy and so forth, and they did, you're quite right, they did carry out the reconnaissance for that big outflanking manoeuvre around the Marathon.
Were there many New Zealanders in the long range desert group?
There were quite a few New Zealanders in the long range desert group. I'm not an expert on it. Dave, you're writing a book on it, aren't you, at the moment?
I'm currently writing a book on it, the long range desert group. They had two patrols of 32 men, two of them were New Zealanders, and they also had quite a lot of New Zealanders in what they called the heavy section, which was their big trucks. Initially they were commanded by the British, but as time went on, more and more New Zealand officers commanded. So I'm sure you'll be very interested in buying my book.
and then Dave will give us a presentation on this in 2025, all right, because next year's all full up, Dave, isn't it?
Are you covering their attack on the Greek islands?
No.
How much difference does it make sending the troops to Greece from the river gardens?
How much difference? In terms of sending those troops to Greece had a huge impact on the war itself, because while the troops are fighting in Greece, and they tended to send some of their best troops, the Australians and New Zealanders and also Kitsuru Nauru aircraft, that's when Rommel arrives in North Africa and decides to carry out a series of raids, and those raids turn into a major offensive and a very successful one. Whereas the deployment to Greece, even Freiburg said it violated every principle of war, but he didn't actually tell the New Zealand government that he didn't agree that they should go. And he almost lost his command over it, because they go to Greece, there's no way they can hold off the attacking Germans who are building up in those countries around them, in Yugoslavia and Albania, and there's a token force. There's an Australian division, the 7th, the New Zealanders, and there's a brigade of tanks which are all antiquated. Now think about 80 aircraft, and the Germans alone have 800 aircraft committed to this campaign. It's a foregone conclusion. And Kippenberger Brigadier said it had the nature of an exercise, the exercise of a withdrawal, because they really didn't engage with the enemy. It's only going to end one way. And of course, many New Zealanders were captured because they couldn't get them all off. But tragic footnote to that, of course, is Crete. To get as many soldiers as they could off Greece, they didn't take them all back to North Africa because that was longer. They dumped them in Crete. And then Freiburg turns up to inspect his men trying to get back to North Africa, and suddenly told, "Oh, well, you're in charge of Crete now." Oh, gee, thanks a lot. So basically, they go from one tragedy. What was Freiburg's words about it. One tragedy to an absolute, one disaster to an absolute tragedy. And that sets back the New Zealanders and the cause of North Africa significantly because of those diversions to places where they couldn't really hold them to begin with.
Considering the New Zealand division proving itself to be an effective offensive force by the end of 1923, and Montgomery wanting to use them for an upcoming invasion of France, but then they're being denied and going to Italy, would you consider their usage in Italy, combined mountain terrain, to be something of a waste as opposed to...
Absolutely, particularly as they've restructured themselves to become, you know, they've got two brigades of infantry and one brigade of armour. You know, and so that's a 30 or forces armoured, and they send them to a country where armour has very little use in that terrain. I think it was probably a waste, and they probably would have been better served. But that's of course it going to be used on D-Day or across the plains of Western France or whatever. Certainly in their shape, that would have been better off there. Because everybody wasn't anticipating that the fighting in Italy would be that long, tough and hard, and that they would still be actively campaigning at the end of 45 and at the beginning of, end of 44 and at the beginning of 45. You know, they just didn't think that would happen. I often wonder about the Italian campaign, whether they should have cut their losses at Rome and just let the Germans stay there, because, you know, they would be going nowhere instead of having to fight to force them out. So to answer your question, I do think they'd probably be better if they'd gone to France, but it didn't happen.
Although it was another front.
It was another front.
It was
front,
really,
yes,
forcing them on another front, wasn't it?
The idea to do this is Churchill's big indirect approach. You know, the soft underbelly of the crocodile. You know, we'll get into Central Europe. We'll be in Vienna by May. That wasn't going to happen, and they kept it going because it's drawing in all these German forces, but there's also, you've got your own forces there as well, you know. I think long and hard about the Italian campaign and whether it was really worth the cost. Yeah.
Bit of a distraction.
Yeah.
Stu? Yeah. You mentioned early on about they learned the lesson not to use tanks on tanks.
Mm.
Isn't that a lesson that's had to be learned over and over again since then? So it's Cambrai there.
When I was a doctrine writer for the Australian Army, we had this cell called Lessons Learned, and I kept telling them, it's not a lesson unless you actually change your behaviour. Otherwise, it's just an observation. And so you're quite right, I should have probably said that was an observation that they made at the time, and perhaps didn't learn from that. But that Medellin battle, which is dismissed as an incident, I think is a really important battle, because one, it shows they finally learned how to deal with tanks, and it also shows that Rommel is not the military genius he's portrayed to be, you know, and that's why they tend to skip over that battle.
I'm
surprised
questions?
Nobody's challenged me on Friday.
No.
You know, I thought that would be heresy, so...
You read the books. That's great, thanks, Glenn. It's an interesting one. My father was in the 8th Reinforcements, and he saw it through, right through to the final activities in Tunis before they went to Italy, and reading his war diaries, it's quite an interesting tale from a soldier's perspective. And also, without wanting to wave the engineer flag, some of our senior engineers also came to the fore during this period, particularly that left hook. And our famous chief divisional engineer, Bull Hanson, in fact, did the reconnaissance, I think, for Monty as well as for Freiburg, didn't he? And in fact, the New Zealanders scored very highly, or got high praise for finding their way around, particularly Wilder's Gap, I think, was a key one, wasn't it? There's some interesting history in there. Thanks, Glenn. And can I just also pass on our thanks, seeing it's the last presentation for the year, and we've had some really excellent ones this year. We've also had the team from City Library, the Heritage team, who send the invites out and provide the venue for us. Stuart here, who does the recordings, the audio recordings, these are all uploaded onto our website. So we've now got 4 years worth of recordings from all the presentations that have taken place, notwithstanding COVID. And thanks once again, Glenn. Excellent. And thank you very much.